Cuban protests are squashed, but the dream of freedom is not. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Protesters in Cuba planned to march on Monday, but the Cuban government curtailed those efforts. Using police and government supporters, Cuban officials kept some of the biggest names in the July protests, artists and journalists, locked up in their homes. We'll get the latest from Havana. Also, speaking of protest, we're going to look at one of the nominees for Song of the Year at the upcoming Latin Grammys, a song born from the freedom cry in Cuba. And finally, a Miami artist has a conversation with a tree about reducing climate change.
I know you know how to do that, but the problem is that we have deforested you. We have removed 3 trillion of you.
All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Well, Cubans on the island stood up and called for political change back in July. They made July 11th one of the most significant days in the island nation's history. This week, people once again plan to take to the streets to demand change and send the government a message. Nora Gámez-Torres covers Cuba and U.S. Latin American policy for El Nuevo Herald and the Miami Herald, and she joins us now to catch us up on what did and didn't happen. Nora, thank you so much for the time. There was a lot of planning for protests that was supposed to happen yesterday in Cuba, but what actually happened?
Thank you, Luis. What happened is that the Cuban government effectively prevented the Cuban people from joining this march that was planned for Monday by this new civic group called Archipiélago, made up of young artists and activists. The march was to protest the government violence unleashed against, you know, the July 11 protesters and to advocate for the release of the political prisoners. They actually notify authorities of the march many weeks in advance. So the government was prepared to suppress it.
And I wondered if November 15th, that yesterday, if that has any significance.
Well, actually, you know, the march was first planned for November 20, but then in response of that, the government announced military exercises. So they changed it to November 15, which was the same day that the government said that it was lifting COVID-related restrictions. So it moved to that. I think, you know, anyway, the day is going to be significant because people are going to remember this march initiative that also had no precedent, just as the July 11 protests. I mean, this group really wanted to test the Cuban constitution approved in 2019, under which in paper, at least, people peaceful demonstrations are allowed. And I think they made their point. You know, they proved the government do not respect their own constitution. It would not tolerate dissent. And it would not tolerate young Cubans peacefully protesting. So they really pushed the government to show its ugly face.
And the government, you touched on it a moment ago, the way they shut it down was really interesting in your reporting. And they went to specific houses and basically kept people inside.
Exactly. There was a massive deployment, really, of the police, the military, special units known as Black Berets. They were sent to patrol the streets. They sent security agents and government supporters to crowd, for example, public spaces, just in case, you know, someone started protesting. And they sent specifically, you know, state workers, members of the Communist Party and other, you know, political organizations to stage the so-called acts of repudiation, which is a practice that Cuban exiles known for many years. It happened in the before the Mariel exodus, and they send them to like the houses of the most known dissidents and promoters of the march. And you know, these images are been circulating, and they're quite shocking.
And circulating, because I remember one of the interesting aspects of the July 11th march is the connectivity people had over the internet and how that helped people organize. And then, of course, the government tried to make internet access much more difficult. What, has anything in that realm changed?
Well, there were no widespread internet access cuts, as we've seen during the July 11 protest. But there are several reports of activists and dissidents whose access to the internet was cut by the Cuban state. But no, there was not a general internet shutdown.
What are you hearing from people on the island today? And I wonder, was this just in Havana?
No, this was not supposed to be in Havana. This was supposed to be an island-wide march. Actually, members of Archipelago notify authorities in several provinces, mostly, you know, across the island. And it was really meant to be a nationwide demonstration.
I wondered about the significance of the color white, because they had, you know, either some people were holding white roses or they were wearing white. One woman was hanging white sheets.
Yeah, I mean, they're using, you know, known symbols, important colors, and, you know, the white rose in Cuban history, they're all associated with José Martí, the independence hero and writer who wrote poems, a very famous poem with a line about, you know, holding a white rose both to friends and enemies. And it's interesting. They're trying to use, of course, Martí, which is a figure in which probably most Cubans can agree on, to try to gather support. And so at some point they said, well, you know what? It's likely that the government would not let us march. So we urge you to be creative and find other ways to protest. So they told people, you know, just wear white, hang sheets from your homes, hug someone, clap at certain hours. I mean, they're trying really to find peaceful ways to protest. And that's been one of their main messages, that this is not a violent movement. I've talked to many of them. They all said that they're not interested in a military intervention, that they don't want violence. And I think that's why also some of them, when they saw the amount of police that was outside, decided not to go out to avoid violence.
And so, I mean, that was the reaction. Once the government mobilized to stop this from happening, to stop any march from happening, once that happened, though, what have you heard from people on the island today? I mean, do they feel still empowered or maybe a little bit down because of what happened?
Well, I mean, there's, you know, a lot of different reactions. I just talked to one of the organizers of the march, this woman you mentioned, Saily Gonzalez. She lives in Santa Clara. She was the one, you know, posting that video about the really an ugly act of repudiation in front of her house. And she told me that they believe this is a victory for them, that they showed they were peaceful, that they forced the government to make this show of force. And they asked Cubans to continue protesting. Actually, Archipiélago published a statement this morning calling people to continue protesting for the coming weeks, finding ways to be creative and to show support for the movement. And I think they're trying now to reconvene and you know, strategize and see what they're going to do next. But in the meantime, they're telling people, because the government did not allow us to go out, we believe, you know, we still need to express ourselves, and we're calling on people, you know, to do the same.
What have you been hearing from the Cuban community here?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. There has been a lot of support, and there's been a lot of exchanges on social media. Thanks to social media, there's been a lot of exchanges between people in the island and people here, which is something that not happens all the time. So it was interesting, you know, how people exchange views Of course, you know, this is a diverse community. There's always people that, you know, have other ideas or are critical or do not share the same tactic. But in general, what I have seen is a surprising amount of unity and support of this march and this new movement led by young artists and young people in general. I mean, that's another point, you know, it's really an opposition movement led by young Cubans.
So what happens next with this protest movement?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that's the big question. They said that they will continue finding other ways to fight actually against the government. They do want political change. And I think, you know, even I mean, I don't think the government can afford to have this level of, you know, police and security forces mobilized all the time. So at some point, you know, I think, you know, this movement, I don't think it's going to be easily crushed as in other cases. I think, you know, social media really makes a change, the difference now. And the fact that so many important voices inside the island, like musicians, writers, actors, intellectuals, they are deserting right now the revolution. Even people that were, you know, symbols.
Yeah, they're the ones that are speaking up the most right now. They're leading this. Again, been talking with Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald reporter Nora Gámez-Torres. The latest on Cuba, find her reporting on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Nora, always a pleasure. Thank you for filling us in.
Thank you, Luis.
Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to discuss the climate crisis with a climate artist from Miami. But first, let's stay with Cuba. We're going to look at how music, specifically one song, is giving protesters that inspiration. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. You know, the power of music has helped galvanize protests for decades. We've been seeing that same phenomenon playing out again across Latin America and the Caribbean. Before we continue our conversation about music and Cuba's latest protests, we wanted to share today's Latin America report on WLRN from America's correspondent Tim Padgett and one of our current interns, Elisa Baena.
It's been half a century since the golden age of protest music in the Americas. Songs like Creedence Clearwater Revival's Fortunate Son that took on the Vietnam War. Some folks are born made to wave the flag, cool their red, white, and blue. Or Caetano Veloso's Alegria, Alegria, a subtle jab at Brazil's military dictatorship. Em caras de presidentes, em grandes beijos de amor. Or Bob Marley's Get Up, Stand Up, an indictment of Caribbean poverty. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. The music helped galvanize protests, and the protests seemed to bring out the best in the music. That same phenomenon is playing out again in Latin America and the Caribbean. The protest hit Patria y Vida, written and performed by several Cuban singers, is up for Song of the Year at Thursday night's Latin Grammy Awards. That matters because on Monday, the Cuban regime blocked a new round of anti-government protest on the island that had been planned after the unprecedented unrest that took place there in July. The song Patria y Vida helped fuel those protests, and the protest helped make Patria y Vida more famous internationally. Or as Cuban protester Daniela Rojo told us,
the song gave us our courage and the protests make the song more popular.
Patria y Vida's success reflects a remarkable synergy between popular music and protest marches across Latin America. WLRN intern Elisa Baena takes a closer look.
It wasn't easy to make it as a rapper in communist Cuba in the 1990s. But that was Yotuel Romero's dream. So at age 19, Yotuel fled the island for Paris. In a few years, he and his group Orishas released a hit album, A Lo Cubano. They were pioneers in an urban music movement in Latin America that blended genres like salsa with hip-hop. Cuba, Orishas, de La Habana. Their song Represent from that album samples music from the famous Cuban band La Sonora Matancera, the one that made Celia Cruz a household name. Over the past two decades, Orishas has collected 8 Grammy and Latin Grammy nominations. Those early songs felt more party than politics. But a few years ago, Yotuel, who's now in his 40s, returned to spend time in Cuba and saw how its human rights and economic misery had only gotten worse since he left. I heard Yotuel reflect on the responsibility of artists during a Billboard panel about music and social justice this past September.
La música no solamente números en Spotify y números en YouTube. La música mueve conciencia, mueve corazón.
Music isn't just Spotify and YouTube numbers. Music should also move people's conscience.
In 2018, Cuban artists founded a pro-democracy movement called Movimiento San Isidro. Yotuel watched from Miami as these Cuban activists protested the government's restrictions on freedom of expression. And to absolutely no one's surprise, the regime cracked down on it. But it helped inspire Yotuel and 5 other Cuban recording artists to release Patria y Vida earlier this year. The title is a poke at the grim regime slogan, Patria o Muerte, homeland or death. Instead, this is homeland and life. Somos humanos, aunque no pensemos iguales. Influenced by the hip-hop tradition of always keeping it real, Yotuel was once again advancing a Latin American musical form, the urban protest anthem. Patria y Vida is a plaintive but hopeful Latin pop song that tells the Cuban regime, ya se acabó, your time is up. The lyrics are biting. In one verse, Yotuel slams the regime for hyping the quote-unquote paradise of Cuban beach resorts, while Cuban mothers cry for their children who've had to flee the island. Patria y Vida was released last February, and its video went viral. Yotuel became the star focus among the ensemble of singers for his movie star looks and build. I mean, have you seen a picture of this guy? In the video, he's shirtless with Patria y Vida painted across his chest. But it was the song's defiant muscle that moved Cubans most. They now had access to the internet. And by this past summer, they were so familiar with Patria y Vida that they adopted it as a rallying cry for mass anti-regime protest marches across the island on that now historic date, July 11th. Patria y Vida! Patria y Vida! Yotuel was kind of stunned, but not completely surprised by the song's effect.
It generated an incredible impact. It helped move a society asleep under a dictatorship to take to the streets.
Here's the thing. In order for this symbiosis between protest movements and protest anthems to work, the song can't just be okay. It has to be hit-worthy. Cuban-American singer-songwriter Lily Blanco says Patria y Vida struck a chord largely because it was so well-written and remarkably genuine.
There's been plenty of songs making the same argument. But I think in the case of Patria y Vida, it's real. I mean, I think what makes it so powerful is that it's not people singing along to a pop song. It's something that people have been feeling for a really long time.
When the international media reported on those spontaneous protests, Patria y Vida experienced a surge in coverage too.
So I want the Cuban Americans to know that we all around this table, and myself included, see your pain.
Yotuel was even invited with other Cuban American leaders to meet with President Biden at the White House in late July.
We hear your voices and we hear the cries of freedom coming from the island.
One reason Yotuel became the song's spokesperson is that some of his collaborators inside Cuba, including Luis Manuel Otero Alcántara, were thrown in jail after the July 11th protests, as were hundreds of protesters, like Daniela Rojo. She's a 26-year-old single mother and artist living in Guanabacoa, Cuba. During the 23 days Rojo spent in jail after the July 11th arrest, she says she angered her cell guard by constantly singing Patria y Vida.
He said that he could make me in trouble, but that song is our anthem. With that song, we start to believe that in Cuba, we can have a different future.
We spoke to Rojo last month. She's still facing a trial, but that hasn't silenced her. She's now active in a new dissident movement called Archipiélago that organized this week's demonstrations. She says Patria y Vida's Latin Grammy nomination only emboldened the group.
I'm so proud of that. I feel we are not alone.
Over the weekend, Rojo was reportedly arrested again, and her whereabouts were unknown. Since July 11th, other Cuban artists have released their own liberation anthems. Algún día tú tendrás tu libertad. This is Nacimos Libres by La Diosa, or The Goddess. She sings, "One day you'll have your freedom, but resist, because we were born free." Porque nacimos libres.
And again, what you heard there is the Latin American Report with WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. Also, WLRN intern, Elisa Vaina, worked on that story. Wonderful story. Tim, by the way, joins us now on the program, along with Cuban-American singer-songwriter Lily Blanco. Tim, Lily, thank you so much for being here today with us. And Tim, a really fascinating piece looking at the role music plays. You know, it mentioned the Latin Grammys this week, and that song is up for Song of the Year. And I'm wondering how big protests, you know, this protest, especially in Cuba, is going to be. How much attention do you think it's going to get in the Latin Grammys, and how much attention it's going to put on Cuba?
Well, I think you could call this the year of not just Latin American protest, but Latin America protest music, as we point out in the piece. And we'll be airing another report as part of this look later in the week, focusing more on Colombia and how protest music helped fuel the anti-government protests there as well, particularly a reggaeton star named Fade, who lives here in Miami, but he's from Medellin. So this synergy, as we call it, between Latin American protests and Latin American protest music has really shown itself this year. And I think it had to have had a big impact on the Latin Grammy nominations, which is why we're seeing Patria y Vida to a large extent there among those nominations for Song of the Year, not just because of the protest, but also because it's just a very good song.
And Lily, I wondered, you know, how important is it, you know, when you have a program like, I mean, you have the Latin Grammys that reaches millions of people around the world to highlight, you know, the plight of the Cuban people. How important is that?
I think it's epic. I think especially a show like the Latin Grammys, where Cuba's been highlighting its talent for decades and decades. There's no secret that Cuba has produced some of the best music in history. And people have always been paying attention. And I think that this is just an opportunity to actually give some music that really has a message, and the world is listening. And I think it's going to be monumental. You also have, you know, one of the guys from the group come to the U.S. and he came here knowing he can't return. And from what I hear, he'll be on stage too. So that should be pretty emotional for a lot of people.
You know, thinking about listening to the piece and again, how Tim brought up, you know, the role that protest songs can have, all the way going back to the Vietnam War through so many other events around the world. And I'm wondering, and Lily, I'll start with you. How big do you think this song is going to play out, you know, when it comes to this movement in Cuba?
Well, I think it's already part of the movement. I think it's part of the voice. One of the few videos that came out yesterday, I'll tell you, I was expecting a big show of people in the streets, and it didn't happen. But one of the few videos that came out was three people on their doorstep dressed in white singing a conga, you know, improvised lyrics about freedom to the revolutionaries who were at their door, you know, harassing them. And so whether it's the lyrics of Patria y Vida or something else, it certainly has empowered, and it's going to continue to do so.
Tim, I mean, you again, your piece this week, and I'm wondering what you think, where this song goes in history.
Well, I think it'll go down in Latin American annals. I think it'll go down as important as some of those Latin American protest songs from the golden age a half a century ago that we pointed out in the beginning of the piece by singers like Caetano Veloso, Ruben Blades, Mercedes Sosa, Latin American protest song giants like that. I think this song could really, you know, lodge itself in that kind of reputation as the years goes on, because it not only because of the protests, but as Lily pointed out in our report, because the song itself is so powerful, it became a cultural vehicle, and that cultural vehicle, as was proved, for example, during the Vietnam War, really does help galvanize protests. For example, yesterday, I mean, Lily pointed out the regime blocked the protests we were expecting to see on the streets. But yet one of the most salient images we have from yesterday is one of the protest leaders who was kept to his house by the regime. He held out a white flower. A white rose, I believe it was, from his window, and that was a very explicit cultural expression that referenced a poem by José Martí, Cuba's most famous poet. Those cultural expressions can be very, very powerful in terms of politics and protest.
Mm. And it's very interesting to me, if I can interject. I think, yeah, a lot of the protest music, or a lot of the music that we look to historically in Cuba, It kind of skirted the issue. A lot of double entendres, you know, a lot of, oh, that's, no, I know what he's saying, I know what he's talking about, I'm going to sing along, and people kind of laughing under their breath, you know. Patria Vida doesn't skirt any issues.
Yeah.
It calls things by their name, and I think, for me, that's something that, you know, if people are willing to stand behind it, it's just going to get more and more powerful. Okay. I'm interested, and I can't wait to see the show, because this year's
the
Latin Grammys, this year's, I guess, Legacy Award or Lifetime Achievement, I'm not sure what it's called, is going to Rubén Blades, who has been an outspoken musician, actor. I mean, he's exposed himself on so many different levels of talent, always making sure to be honest and tell the truth, and he's had his own history of protests
again, you know? Yes, oh no, definitely. Again, talking with Cuban American singer songwriter Lily Blanco and also WLRN America's correspondent Tim Padgett, and talking about the role that music, but specifically one song, as we've been discussing, Patria y Vida, how that song is galvanizing Cubans here in the United States, also back in Cuba, around the world, as this movement continues to try to build itself up. And you could find out more about the story and listen to the story, by the way, later today on All Things Considered, or go to WLRN.org. You know, Tim, talking with Nora earlier about what happened, what's going on in Cuba, and I wanted to get a sense of how information is getting around. And I'm just wondering, like, with this song, how it gets around, because, you know, again, internet access, not as easy in Cuba as anywhere else.
Well, this is also a question I think Lily should jump in on as well, because she and I talked about this a lot in our interview. She made the very explicit point that social media has a lot to do with this. You have to remember that Cubans only gained access to the internet and social media just a few years ago, and if not for that, I don't think that Cubans would have been as exposed or as familiar with Patria y Vida and the video and the song without it. And the song was released in February, and between February and July 11th, when these protests occurred, Cubans just started devouring this song on the social media that they suddenly had access to, so that by the time they were ready to hit the streets, they knew that this was going to be their rallying cry. And the internet and social media was, I think, imperative in this. And I think Lily would agree.
And Lily, I mean, what, you know, we take it for granted, but what social media and, you know, the role that it's played so far in Cuba?
Well, I think it's a perfect recipe. I mean, you have a large youth. Who's interested in learning and who's educated by the most part. You know, these are people who, they get their hands on technology and they have been creative, you know, before the phones came in, before the social media. The Cuban people are very inventive. It's out of necessity you create masterful invention. And I think that putting these cell phones in people's hands who have nothing else to do, really, because, you know, what are you going to do, stand in line for 3 hours to wait to see if there's food? It's been sort of entertainment, but they've really gotten their hands in the mix. They understand how it works. You see musicians out of Cuba, La Diosa was mentioned earlier, who they've just mastered the social media,
but what are they using?
Resources. They download an app. They put together Instagram posts. They put together videos. They stream concerts online.
So
things
would think
a country that's so necessitated, you know.
Is it mostly Instagram? Is it mostly Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, or
what? Lot of Instagram, a lot of Facebook. I understand that they use WhatsApp differently than we do, which we use it just for phone, you know, purposes or communication, perhaps, when we travel. In Cuba, it's Twitter, you know.
It's Telegram as well. That's become one of the newest vehicles there on the island. They're really learning how to use that, particularly since July 11th. The regime has been cracking down on trying to cut off the internet and social media, and they found, for example, that Telegram is a little better encrypted and works even better than WhatsApp for them in terms of getting around the regime.
Yoani Sanchez, the one of the most famous dissenters, she quickly in the morning posted, "My internet has been cut out of my house, but thanks to our creative ways, we figured out another way to post." And yeah, she was posting, not repeated it all day, but she was able to post 3 or 4 times.
And this goes, yeah, you know what, Nora kind of
tunnels.
Nora touched on this. So is it that's made communication between Cubans here and Cubans back on the island a lot easier, hasn't it?
Yes, sir, for sure. And, you know, one of the things about Patria Vida that's interesting is, you know, it's not just where it started with the artists and with the musicians or whatnot. Again, one of the few videos that came out yesterday, it was a nurse dressed in her nursing outfit, and they had written across it, Patria Vida, and she wrote, "Cuba, save yourself," on one side of her body, and Patria Vida on the other. You had a gentleman who was cited for God knows what, and when he went to go, you know, dispute the ticket, he showed up with a Patria Vida t-shirt. And so these are people that are actually putting, they're not just crazy artists who, you know, have nothing to lose. These are people whose careers are on the line and whose family safety is on the line. And
it could be
the music goes beyond the artists. It really touches the whole people.
It could be dangerous, right, in Cuba if you play that song.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, as we pointed out in the report, one of the protesters, the leading protesters that we interviewed for the piece, Daniela Rojo, who's one of the leading activists of this new dissident movement called Archipelago, which was organizing what was supposed to be the demonstrations for this week. She was arrested again on Friday, as we noted, and no one seems to know her whereabouts. And that's been a real distressing piece of news for everyone over the past few days.
And the story, like all others coming out of Cuba, that we're going to keep our eyes on. Again, I want to thank WLRN America's correspondent Tim Padgett and Cuban-American singer-songwriter Lily Blanco. And again, check out the piece. You can either listen to it again this afternoon on All Things Considered, or just go to our website, WLRN.org, and check it out there. Tim, Lily, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the opportunity and for your voices.
Thank you, Lewis.
And somehow I get the feeling the Cuban government probably not going to be watching the Latin Grammys this year. Well, still to come, what can we learn about climate change by talking to trees? One artist gave it a try recently. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Do you remember the story of The Giving Tree? It's the book by Shel Silverstein. Every day, a boy comes to visit the tree, and the tree gives him its apples and shade to play in. And that boy grows up, and the tree just keeps on giving. The boy takes the branches to build a home. The tree gives and gives until it's nothing but a stump. You know, it's a story that fits well around the conversation of climate change that's happening around the world. We've all experienced a giving tree in some way. I want you to think, if you could say something to your giving tree, what would you say? Well, here's what Xavier Cortada said to his tree.
I really think that greed's going to win the day here, and self-interest. And I think a lot of you are going to be chopped down for more development.
He's an artist and University of Miami professor, and he's having a conversation with a tree there at the 2021 United Nations Climate Change Conference in Glasgow, and he joins us now. Xavier, great to have you back on the program.
Great to be here. Thank you so much. I just flew in from Glasgow yesterday, so happy to talk to you today.
Wow. Okay. All right. Hopefully you're not feeling that jet lag. But, you know, it's so fascinating. You had a number of conversations with the tree while you were at COP26. Where did that idea come from?
Well, COP26 is this major international conference where world leaders come together. They've been doing it 25 other times before to try to figure out how to address the climate crisis. And part of that climate crisis has to do with not deforesting our planet and, importantly, not polluting it with carbon in the atmosphere. We all know plants capture carbon. So trees and forests are really important to help us not have the kind of climate change that brings in hurricanes and strong storms. Well, anyway, in the middle of this conference with tens of thousands of people, there's this corridor, a really important corridor, because it's the pathway between the session where all the nation pavilions are and then the meeting rooms where the delegates actually sit down and decide what the COP26 negotiations are going to be. And along that corridor, in a bizarre way, there were these trees put in oak barrels. And I just saw this tree as a metaphor for what was happening at the conference. And as I saw people just whizzing by it, you know, diplomats, it's kind of funny when they walk, you know, they walk with their security team and their PR team, they walk in blocks one after the other. So everyone's swirling around these trees and not really paying much attention to them. So I decided to do a performance art piece across the entire span of the conference by having a conversation with this tree.
You plot yourself down in front of the tree. You get a chair, you sit there, and then the camera's off a little bit further off, I guess, across the hall. And so here you are. And by the way, we shared it on our social media, WLRN Sundial, this video. You got to watch it. Here's Xavier talking to a tree, having a very profound conversation with this tree. Nobody stops. A few people look at you, I notice, but nobody stops.
Right.
To talk to you and see what's going on.
Right. Well, and that's, in a way, I think that's what was happening to the tree. So look, the tree, to me, I normally don't talk to trees. I admire them. I've planted thousands of them through my participatory art projects. I eat from them. And every now and then I enjoy their shade and definitely the oxygen they create. But I never really talk to trees. But I had to talk to this tree because this tree was a sentinel. To me, it was there witnessing a really important moment in human history. And it stood as a witness to what was going to happen to all the other trees. We humans have cut down 3 trillion trees. Across this planet. There's a pledge to plant 1 trillion of those. And in a bizarre way, right after I was done talking to that tree, there was a promise made that we would not deforest 80%
and
of...
What it was is world leaders had promised to end and reverse deforestation by 2030.
Yeah. And the truth is that I told the tree in my performance piece a few days later that what they promised was to repromise what they had promised before. And this promise was kind of weak in that Indonesia could cut down a forest and plant a monoculture agriculturally and still call that a forest and keep its promise. And Brazil could continue deforesting the Amazon, use it for logging, plant other trees for logging, and it would still be part of foresting. So I was telling the tree that although there had been this major promise made, it didn't have any teeth, right? The promise didn't have any teeth, and it was a precursor for what was supposed to come. Throughout the conference, I kept on updating the tree. I even watered the tree once because what was happening was literally the tree was dying. It was literally turning brown in front of our very eyes.
Wait a second. They put these trees up and they're not even watering their own trees.
Right. Again, look, there's a lot of really important things to talk about, right? You're hearing like you have former U.S. presidents, you have the current U.S. president, you have Nancy Pelosi, who I got to talk to for a minute. You had John Kerry. You had all these major leaders talking with, again, the Saudi Arabian, you know, energy minister. You know, like, this is a major, major conference.
No, everybody, yeah, everybody,
the world was there. You know,
everybody was there. But you know what? Here's the thing, though. Some of our representatives from South Florida were there. The mayor, both are mayors, actually. I believe Francis Suarez and Daniel Olivencava.
Yeah, I actually went with Daniela. In fact, this project I did in Miami, I launched with her at the Port of Miami. She announced her pledge to reduce carbon emissions from Miami-Dade County by 100% by 2050 and by half by 2030, in keeping with what this conference was supposed to do. It was a major conference, but you know, the tree to me was this metaphor for how we take care of our environment. In many ways, I think it speaks to the problem we have on this planet, and that is that we value things that are useful to us, and we don't, and that are useful. And here's the problem: that are useful to us now, but we don't have a sense of what future generations will receive. So if the tree is of no service to me after the conference, right, because it's a decorative item, then I don't need to worry about watering it, because it's just here to sit pretty as a decorative item during the conference. In many ways, that's what's happening with our planet today as we deforest it, you know?
I want you to hold the thought of the tree for a minute. By the way, again, I'm talking with artist and University of Miami professor Xavier Cortada, who attended the climate conference in Glasgow recently, again, COP26. And by the way, you can find a link to his work and a link to a digital diary of his time at the conference on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And also, again, this video of the conversation that he had with the tree. I wanted to ask you about, the journey you took to Glasgow, linked to a project, an art project that you've been working on. It's titled Hello. And it's one where people can participate. Briefly tell me about it.
Sure. So Hello is the project for a piece I did where, instead of giving people name tags that say, hello, my name is, it instead asked them to say, to answer the question, hello, my hope is, or hello, my fear is, or my purpose is, or my future is. And we launched it with hello, my elevation is. And the reason I did that is I wanted to create the sense of urgency among these delegates so they wouldn't see each other the way they ultimately did, which is as nation states, each competing for their own individual interest, but instead see themselves for the purpose that they came to the conference to solve, right? So I would have people from African nations, Latin American nations, European nations come and write their purpose on a name tag and put it on their chest. And I did that throughout the entirety of the conference, and it yielded some pretty interesting results.
Like what? What are some of the really?
There's some really awesome ones. For instance, for the elevation one, that was a quick hit with Micronesia, right? Because I had mine saying my elevation is 6 feet above sea level. And Micronesia had one that said the same thing. So here's a Pacific island that's clamoring for people to stop fossil fuels, right? To stop subsidies of fossil fuels because their islands are going to sink. And I met with them in their delegation. I even spoke to them at one of their meetings about how Miami and Micronesia were literally at the same elevation. Others dealt with hope. So some people had hope in a better future, hope for a just world, hope that we keep our temperature under 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial averages, which is what causes the pole. You know, that's the whole premise.
And that's the goal from the UN. Let's try not to get above that, or we start to see some really dire consequences. Is this a project you're still working on? Are you bringing it to Miami?
Sure. In fact, I actually, if you go to that website, cortada.com/hello, there you see what Miamians wrote, because that was the other issue. It has an interactive component. You just click on participate, and there you can see what people wrote for hope, what they wanted the conference delegates to read. Some other delegates basically feared greed. They feared more wildfires. Others feared that time was running out. Others feared their current, present, and their future. And for folks, some folks said, my future is now. And a really interesting one wrote, my future is what we decide today. And there was this one kid who wrote, my future is love. And I actually think that that's really a poignant one. We're going to need a lot of love for one another in the future, because the legacy of COP26 is one where we're going to let our children and grandchildren fend for themselves in a world that's going to be warmer. Coral reefs will not exist if we break beyond the 1.5.
Yeah.
That means that the collapse of fisheries and ecosystems, right?
But you know what?
There's a lot of love that we're going to need to solve the chaos that's going to come to this world.
You know what, Xavier? Here's the thing, though. We've talked about this before, and I'm wondering, these promises, we've seen them before. We've been making them for a while. Did anything, being there on the ground at COP26, did anything strike you as being different this time around?
Yeah, look, it was different that we had American presence at COP26 in full force. Trump walked away from Paris and was the worst environmental president we've ever had. Our nation is there. So that was significant. I saw John Kerry at a restaurant. I saw him walking up and down the hallways. I saw Nancy Pelosi with her entire delegation, American mayors. America was there. And we're the biggest, you know, we're one of the biggest polluters, and we were there trying to curb it. So that was important. But you know what was even more important? Because at the end of the day, COP26 failed us. At the end of the day, they watered down the language. It's no longer what it was supposed to be, which was phasing out coal. It's now phasing it down,
right,
which lets polluters continue to pollute. But what was inspiring, absolutely inspiring, was the 130,000 people I marched with, not inside COP, but all outside.
Right. A lot of people did show up for that.
And then there was Greta, right? Greta Thunberg speaking loudly and powerfully, organizing youth, telling youth and the 130,000 assembled that what they were seeing there was what leadership looked like.
You know,
and
only because of time. I've always taken you as a very positive, you know, person in your view of the future. And I wonder, you know, for you, I mean, look, climate change is one of those things, especially with the younger generation, I've noticed it can be very paralyzing, and there's a lot of fear. But, you know, what should people think about? What do you think people should be thinking about of the impact they could have on this issue?
Yeah, I'm not demoralized. I'm not agonizing, I'm mobilizing, right? In other words, look, the world leaders failed us, but we expected that. Why? Because fossil fuel, there were more, if the fossil fuel industry was a nation, they'd have the highest delegation at COP. There were more fossil fuel lobbyists there than any national delegation alone. And China was absent, and India decided to kick the can down the road, which is going to be detrimental to all of us, but also for them and their society when heat starts going to 130 degrees Fahrenheit and people start dying all over India, right? So there's a lot of bad, negative things that I could focus on, because we really are going to let biodiversity down, and many, many people will suffer, and nation states will collapse if we continue at this trend. But my hope is that at every corner of this planet, there are people who care enough to do something. And I know that the youth movement, the youth leadership, the youth climate movement was there in full force. I was lucky enough to walk right behind them, the way they managed that. That route of 130,000 people, that wasn't led by other people and the kids were their puppets. The kids were literally in charge of the whole thing, every step of the way.
The videos were amazing. The videos were
amazing.
And they
have the power. They shamed. They were in that room. I spoke to delegates and they were so grateful that I was at the Russia Pavilion while Russia was having a greenwashing comment, and 20 kids showed up, putting their hands up in the air, saying lies, 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 right? Like, that embarrasses governments, because they're fearless, and they have the conviction to speak truth to power.
Not good to have kids do that. Real quickly, I just want to know, I got to know, What happened to that tree?
I gave it its last rites. I tried everything I could to save that tree. I even had some artists that were ready to plant it, but bureaucracy got in the way. It's the same reason why we didn't get the agreement we wanted. I gave it its last rites, and I told it that.
Let's hope that the tree, I hope it did all right. But I'm glad that you had the conversation with it. Artist and University of Miami professor Xavier Cortada, again, check out the video. Go to our social media, WLRN Sundial. A really interesting conversation. Xavier, always a pleasure. I really appreciate it. Can't wait to get you back here in the studio to talk some more.
Same here. Love being in your show. Thank you for thank you for the platform you provide to our community and to artists especially. You're awesome that way.
Thank you so much. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, November 16th. No show tomorrow, Miami-Dade County School Board meeting. We're back on Thursday. And by the way, on Thursday, we're going to be talking about rent and how rents are going up everywhere. And we want to hear from you. If you're out there right now trying to find a place to rent, or, you know, what's that search like? And what are you giving up in order to have the place you want? Email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.